Luke 14, and we commence at verse 25, sorry. Luke 14, verses 25 to 34. So, the title of this piece in our church Bibles is called The Cost of Being a Disciple, and we're going to hear some more about that shortly. Large crowds were travelling with Jesus, and turning to them, he said, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, his wife and children, his brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. And anyone who does not carry his cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. Suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Will he not first sit down and estimate the costs to see if he has enough money to complete it? For if he lays the foundation and is not able to finish it, everyone who sees it will ridicule him, saying, 'This fellow began to build and was not able to finish.' Or suppose a king is about to go to war against another king. Will he not first sit down and consider whether he is able, with 10,000 men, to oppose the one coming against him with 20,000? If he is not able, he will send a delegation while the other is still a long way off, and will ask for terms of peace. In the same way, any of you who does not give up everything he cannot, or everything he has, cannot be my disciple. Salt is good, but if it loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again?" Let's turn the page. "It is nor for the manure pile, it is thrown out. He who has ears to hear, let him hear."
He's an expert in disgust. That's a funny little profession, isn't it? But he observed that a single cockroach will completely wreck the appeal of a bowl of cherries. But a cherry will do nothing at all for a bowl of cockroaches. Great little observation. Kind of closer to home and probably more helpful. John Gottman, I don't know if you know John Gottman, but it's a line of psychology that focuses on marriages. He, through research, has shown that it takes 5 positive statements to outweigh the impact of 1 negative one in a relationship. So you say something negative, you got to respond with that 5 times more, 5 times over. By the way, the other side thing that I noted when I was doing some reading on from him, he said that the predictor of whether you have a good relationship is not whether it's positive, it's how many negatives you say. So you can, if you just start cutting down on your negative statements to one another, it's going to help you a heck of a lot. But negatives have a much more powerful impact on us than positives. And there are lots of interesting things about that. But if you're trying to recruit somebody to join you, it would mean that you need to emphasize the positives and minimize the negatives. That's, if you want people to sign up, that's what you would do. So why is Jesus emphasizing the negatives of following him? Like, if you stood up at Big Week Out, now would you have stood up at Big Week Out if they said to you, look, if you stand up, you're going to lose all your money, you'll have no friends, and you may lose your life. It's not a great sales pitch. And that, frankly, is what Jesus has done in this passage. Is he says to his followers, look, sit down and, in a sense, write out a budget. Figure out whether you can afford to follow me. So he then tells the followers what it will cost to follow him. It'll cost you, in verses 25 and 26, it'll cost you your family and friends. You need to, his words are, hate. Did you see that? If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, his wife and children, his brothers and sisters, they can't follow me. Hate's an especially strong word. We'd like to minimize the tension on this very quickly, especially for Bible teachers. And we say, well, it's a contrast thing. You've got to have your love for God so much higher than your love for family. But let's just deal with the word as it is. Jesus says you need to hate your family. So that's part of the cost, is it costs you your family. It costs you your life. We saw that in that same verse there, even your own life. It costs you, in verse 33, your possessions. Any of you who does not give up everything he has cannot be my disciple. It costs you your closest people to you. It costs you your possessions, and it costs you your life. And then he has this powerful graphic metaphor to sum it all up, I think, in verse 27. Anyone who does not carry his cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. Crosses weren't good things. We know pretty much what a cross is like, because that's where Jesus ended up. And Jesus says you need to take a hold of your life as if you're going to die on a cross to follow me. So if you sat down and did the sums and started counting the cost, it would be very reasonable to say, I'm not following you, Jesus. I think that would be sensible of you to do that. Is Jesus worth following is a really powerful question that drops out of this, given all the costs he names. It would be reasonable if the circumstances were reasonable. If a politician said to you, and we have an election this year, but I'm not expecting Scott Morrison to say this, but if a politician said to you, vote for me, because if you do, you'll lose your home, I'm going to give you higher taxes and lower wages. No one's voting for that politician. But there is a politician who stood in front of his nation and said these words, we shall go to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our nation, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. Winston Churchill said those words in World War II. He called for an extraordinary action with massive cost. I mean, these plaques around us remind us of Australians' part in all of that. But if you go through villages of England or Britain, you see extraordinary cost to every village. Called for extraordinary action and sacrifice because there's an extraordinary threat. Nazism is coming across the waters. These weren't reasonable or ordinary times. So he didn't ask for reasonable things. Large crowds are following Jesus. We see that in verse 25 there. They're following Jesus because he's doing amazing miracles and saying provocative words. But where's his journey leading? Where, if you follow Jesus further from here, where will he end up? Jesus himself knows. He says this in chapter 9 of Luke. He says, the Son of Man must suffer many things, be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law. He must be killed, and on the third day he will be raised to life. Jesus knows his pathway is leading to confrontation, rejection, and death. He knows that he will lose his family, his possessions, his life. He will take up a cross and experience all of its brutality. So is it fair, if you know you're going that way, to then hide from your followers the reality of what's to come? Jesus has no hidden clauses. It's an honest thing when he says to them, if you're going to follow me, here's what's at stake. Your families will be against you. Your possessions will be taken from you. You will lose your life. The cross will mean something to you. A friend of mine who's in business, I always think of him as an optimist. He tells me he's not. There's a few optimists in this building who are in business. It's not you, so you can. But what he does is he said to me, he tests himself against the worst possible case. He says, if this completely goes south, what will it look like? And can we still do this? So he, when I meet with him, I find him extraordinarily positive, whatever's happening. Because he says, I tested it on the worst case possible, and I think we can still do it. And this is what Jesus asks his followers to do. Test yourself on the worst possible outcomes. And would you still do it anyway? Would you still follow me? For most of us, the loss of family possessions and our lives are not likely to happen in our country at this time. I can assure you probably the next year will look okay in that area. But for many people in history and even in our time, that is not true. There are people in even in our church who have fled their country because they chose to follow Jesus, and it meant rejection of them from their family, from their friends. It meant loss of, it has meant loss of possessions. It has meant loss of country. And they find themselves here now as refugees. Those are people who are in our church who have experienced that. You don't have to go too far to find many stories of Christians who still find that that is true for them. But for us, it will probably not be true. We won't have that level of challenge. But it definitely reminds us, don't take the Christian faith as a sideline hobby. Like many of us have commitments, volunteering commitments that we make. We could be in school, we could be part of a sporting club, or working alongside a project, helping vulnerable people. Those things have costs. Those things ask something of us, but they're sideline efforts. I have a range of things I do in school and for various other organisations. And to be honest, if my priority stuff, my core life stuff, pushes up against those other things, it's reasonable to bump them. Because I have this main job. I've got family, I've got a work, I've got things that I must do, and these other things, well, you know, I gave up school, doing the school cricket coordinating because it wasn't fitting. When it comes to faith, you don't get to bump it. You don't get to say it's not fitting in all these other priorities now. It's not a hobby. It has a high demand on you. Let's not misunderstand though, life itself is costly. Have you noticed that? It's constant. Every week you're making choices of counting the cost, of finding that that cost is difficult, but this one's even more difficult, so I'll just do difficult. Following Jesus focuses those costs even further, and all those choices. Because when we follow Jesus, if we take what he says as truth, then we need to make decisions on what is not best for me, and also what is not necessarily best for my family or my marriage. Which sounds like terrible news. Because Christian faith is known for its family values. We affirm marriage. It's a very high value to us. Because Jesus himself affirms it. And family and children, all these things, and even loving ourselves, these are all important parts of following Jesus, but it turns out it's not more important than following Jesus. These things don't have the highest claim on us. And in fact, if Jesus were to say, if you're going to compare the two things, following me versus following your family and doing what your family wants, the word you need to use is hate. You need to hate your family. And it's extraordinarily polarizing, and it pushes us to go, oh, I don't understand how that works. I love my children. They are probably four of the most important people in my life. I'm also married, so my wife is also incredibly important. I love my children. I want to do good for them as much as I possibly can. But as I do that, I also want to model loving God and loving our neighbour. I want to do that because I think it's not just good for me, it's good for them to see that life is full of this blessing and it's full of sacrifice, it's full of abundance and it's full of cost. They need to see that. And so they need to know that they're vitally, incredibly, utterly important, but not the most important. Because not only do I hope that for me that that would be true, I hope that for them. I hope that they themselves will count the cost and follow Jesus. And I need to check my behaviour to make sure that the way I behave shows that priority in my life. When we came to this church, and I know you love this church, but at the time my kids did not know this church, so they did not love it. They loved the church we were in. The problem with pastors, or at least pastors like me, is we change every now and then. So they were in a church up at Blackwood for some years and got great friends, excellent youth group, great fun. And then their dad said, I'm changing churches. And I wasn't sure what church we were going to change to. Should we go to Melbourne? Should we go overseas? New Zealand seemed good at that time of year. Should we go across town? I wasn't sure. But I know, I'm looking at my kids, I know that was an extraordinarily difficult conversation for my kids. Because they did not want to change. It was even good for them to stay at a good church. Because nothing wrong with the church. Very hard for us as a family. And so we worked on it as a family. Turned out I needed to say no to some churches because my family said no, and that was no. When it came to this church, we prayed about it. I think they settled on it quicker than I did. But here we are. And that journey was important because it told us all they're incredibly important, but sometimes we make choices that are costly. I'm a pastor's kid, right? So I get their pain. And I was a pastor's kid growing up in probably one of the poorest churches in Adelaide, working among some of the poorest people. So I get what it looks like when parents and the following Jesus life pushes the family into places that are hard and sacrificial. I would say my parents got it mostly right and sometimes wrong. But that's part of the cost too. It's the risk. It's sometimes in the midst of incredible challenge, you make a choice and you don't realise what kind of cost it'll bring. But that's the thing that I've had to learn. Is that following Jesus means we honour God and we live for the good of others and it really does cost. And Jesus isn't hiding those facts. So negatives have this really powerful impact on us, much more than the positives. He puts to the crowd, if you're going to follow me, this is what it looks like and it looks dreadful. The most reasonable thing to decide would be, I won't follow. Yet the early disciples stayed. And many are here today following Jesus. Why? Why are you here? Why is it worth following Jesus? I think it's because those of us who say yes to Jesus believe that what we gain is way more outrageous than the costs we count. Firstly, what we gain in Jesus is he bears our cost. You know, in all that crowd, there's only one person who actually gave up family, lost his friends, gave up his possessions and gave up his life, went to a cross. That person was Jesus. And why? Well, he did all of that for us. Because
what Jesus was doing on the cross is exchanging with us all that is messed up and then giving to us all that is great. He exchanged with us, he gave us honour, even though we had shame. He gave us forgiveness for our sins. He rescues us from darkness. He gives us light for confusion. He gives us a home because we're strangers. You know, when you think about it, maybe we should consider what is the cost of not following Jesus. Ephesians 2 says this about people who don't follow Jesus. You're dead in your transgressions and sins, captive to the ways of this world and the ruler of the kingdom of the air. You gratify the cravings of your flesh and follow its desires and thoughts. You are deserving of wrath. There's the cost of not following Jesus. It's a terrible cost. And by the way, the devil does not want you to know that detail. When you go out into a world and do your own thing, all you see are benefits. You do not realize what it is costing you. So Ephesians 2 says this, that because of his great love for us, God, who is rich in mercy, made us alive with Christ even when we were dead in transgressions. It is by grace you have been saved. Jesus bore our cross. He took us from being under wrath and in transgression and sin, and he rescued us and made us alive because of his great grace. So that's the primary thing, I think, when it comes to why would we say yes, is because that is ridiculous what we have gained through Jesus. A missionary called C.T. Studd put it like this: if Jesus Christ be God and died for me, then no sacrifice can be too great for me to make for him. What it meant for him in 1887 is he left his home, he left his career, I guess, as an English cricketer. He became a missionary to China and then Sudan. He gave away a fortune to people like George Muller. And then eventually he died alone on a mission field. That's what it meant for him. But he was motivated by what Jesus had done for him in the great grace of God. The second thing I think about why we would follow Jesus anyway is we know that following Jesus means not less, it means more. Uncle Doug gave us a great illustration of that. Jesus says to us to give up our families, our possessions and our life. And it's not in exchange for something better, like your current family model is terrible, I've got a great one for you. It's as an entrance into something bigger. You know, discipleship isn't about giving up everything and everyone, never to see them again. There are definitely costs on the way through, things that we need to think about and even mourn. I've known young people who, because they became followers of Jesus, were told that they were never allowed to read Bibles, never allowed to go to church anymore. And so they've lived for years with this sense of disappointment from parents just because they became followers of Jesus. Is that not something to be mourned? I mourn for them. But actually, there is so much to be gained. So much to be gained. Because let's take family. My family left the church they loved, thinking about what they were to lose. And here we are, 20 months on. They now have new friends. They now have people who look out for them, leaders that are great. We're in a church where people we didn't know and love, we now know and love. We've made friends. We consider you as family. Following Jesus has meant that there's some sense of cost here, but we never knew what we would gain over there. And that's what it is in following Jesus, is maybe we might lose father and mother, sister and brother. But then we find there are friends and strangers who become brothers and sisters, and even our fathers and mothers that we lose, sisters and brothers may come too. Over the last, 20 years, God has been so kind in my mother's family and bringing uncles and aunties and cousins to follow him. My family's just getting bigger as I follow Jesus. You know, following Jesus means that as we don't cling to our possessions and we give out generously and freely, people are better off. We're not poorer, we're actually richer. Following Jesus means that if I don't hold my life tightly, if I don't try to protect my reputation, try to make myself important, I find I gain life, take more risks. I'm better for the world. So were you counting? Were you counting the cost of what it follows Jesus, means to follow Jesus? I want to ask you this simple question. Is following Jesus worthwhile? Do you want to do it? Let me pray. God, you ask of us what we think is extraordinary, maybe even too much. You ask us to give it up. You're constantly doing it. You might be chasing down a career with grand ambitions, and through the circumstances of life or the challenge in our personal time with you, you ask us to give it up and choose a different way. And every time we feel like the cost is high, and in the moment it feels so bad, yet I reckon all of us could look back and say, every time you've done that, we've come out of it richer. And today you're challenging us on the place of our families, our friends, the place of our own lives, our possessions. And you're challenging us on that. You're asking about where our priorities lie. In the midst of great challenge, will we follow you anyway? You're worth it, as far as I'm concerned. And I pray, our God, that you'd birth in all of us that great conviction that says it's worth the cost. We'll get it done. We will follow you faithfully. Amen.